Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for our fifth nationwide language access webinar, Preparing a Diverse Community, Emergency Response Plans for Limited English Proficient Communities. My name is Lorene Leglegaren, and I am a policy analyst for the Migration Policy Institute's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and I will be your moderator for the next 90 minutes. I'll be giving you a three-minute overview of our work at MPI before I hand it over to our speakers this afternoon. The Migration Policy Institute is a nonprofit, independent, nonpartisan think tank dedicated to the study of movement of people worldwide. At MPI, we have a holistic approach to migration, and the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy is just one of our program areas. At the center, we maintain the Language Portal, a translation and interpretation digital library available at www.migrationpolicy.org/language-portal. And you'll see a screenshot of our Language Portal on your screens in front of you right now. The portal features over 1,600 resources for language access practitioners. For example, if you enter our database by hitting where the red arrow is pointing, you can search for hundreds of state and local agency documents, including sample contracts, translated material, and LEP policies from throughout the United States. And so this is what our search engine looks like. Our webinars are an extension of our work on language access. Featuring speakers in state and local government and community-based organizations, our webinars provide an interactive platform to discuss and analyze key issues in the field of language access. Past webinars, including audio and related documents, can be downloaded from our website. For example, if you hit listen where the red arrow is pointed from our website, you will be directed to our webinar archives. And here, if we select our second webinar, Developing Partnerships to Provide Interpreter Training and Language Referrals, you will be directed to a site that has a program summary, key questions and answers, the PowerPoint presentation, audio and related resources. Similarly, at the end of this webinar, we will have a page based on this webinar posted a few weeks from now. So just a few quick logistic reminders. If you have any problems accessing this webinar, please contact us by email at khayden@migrationpolicy.org. I will spell that for you. khayden@migrationpolicy.org. And I'd like to take this time to thank Kristen Hayden for her extraordinary help in setting up this webinar with a record number of participants. I think the last time we checked, it was 161 people registered. Instructions and background information about our speakers and the Migration Policy Institute were sent in advance. Please email us if you did not receive them. Also, you will receive a copy of today's PowerPoint presentation and a brief survey by email after today's call. This webinar is being recorded, and a recording of this webinar will be available. If you do not wish to be recorded, please do not ask any voice questions. You will still be able to ask questions by chat function. During the formal presentation, simply enter your question and hit return in the chat box, and we will keep your question in a line, in a queue, so that we can make sure to ask it at the end of our presentations. The default setting on your call is mute, so you will need to indicate to us that you have a voice question by pressing star 1 so that we can identify you and unmute your line in order for you to ask a question audible to the entire group. Due to the large number of participants on this call, we have hidden the chat box function this time around, so you will not be able to see other people's questions. We did not want this to be a distraction, but of course, we welcome your feedback on whether or not you thought our decision worked this time around. With such a large number of participants on this call today, I'll have to be fairly strict with time and questions, and unfortunately, you'll hear me interrupting our speakers when they have 1 minute left. So, this webinar is especially timely as we recognize that September is National Preparedness Month. Moreover, preparations for the H1N1 virus are in full swing, and I would like to thank Uma Aluwalia and Betty Lamb from Montgomery County for sharing their work in preparing for H1N1. I'd also like to thank Herman Schaffer from New York City's Office of Emergency Management for sharing his work on the Ready New York pandemic flu campaign. And finally, I would also like to thank our team in Hawaii, Gerald Ota, Marsha Tamura, and Barbara Yamashita, for sharing their work on Hawaii's language identification and emergency card. Lastly, I'd like to thank the NEKC Foundation for making this call possible. You have a copy of our speakers' bios in your presentation in the email that we sent out earlier. So I will stop talking now and let all three of our presentations take the floor. We will start with Hawaii, then we will move on to New York, and then finally Montgomery County, and then we will ask you to save your questions for any of the presentations at the end of all three. So over to you, Hawaii. And so, Hawaii, we are just in the process of unmuting your call right now. So give us 1 second. So we haven't started yet. Okay, you are now ready to go, Hawaii.
Aloha kakahiako. Good morning. It's 9:35 in Hawaii in the morning. First of all, we'll be speaking about a very special project that started in the way many projects do, with a germ of an idea that became something much grander and much bigger and hopefully much more successful than our original intention. This started off as simply an iLanguage identification card that many of you are familiar with. And the Interagency Council on Immigrant Services, which is a group of advocacy organizations as well as public organizations, as well as federal organizations, came across a card that was developed by someone in Chinatown, Mrs. Yukpang Law, who is very well known to us here. She developed a Chinese medical card, and we took off on that basically for an identification card only, trying to make it a Hawaii-based one. And that's because in Hawaii, 24% of the population of about 3 million now speak a language other than English at home. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're all non-English speaking, but certainly many of them are. As you can see by this next chart, the languages spoken at home pretty much track mostly Asian languages, although we are very much increasing with Spanish as a language. That started off at about 6%, and now it's 11%. It's a growing proportion of our languages. This does not show the linguistic isolation of some of the other populations in Hawaii, which create a large need for us on a bilingual basis. And those are particularly those from the what used to be called the Trust Territories. It's the Marshallese, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, Chukis and Pohnpeian from what we call the Federated States of Micronesia. Those people are coming here because they're part of a compact of free association that we have basically a treaty with these independent states which allow them to come here, unlike certain other immigrants or other peoples. And they create a large impact on our services. Let me give you to Barbara, let me just give you one more point. One more point was that this survey information was based on a bioterrorism response. We did a marketing survey back in 2003 and followed it up with some extrapolations, and this is why we have our language data. So it does follow the preparedness genesis. Barbara.
Good morning. Part of my role is I'm one of the liaisons to the State Civil Defense Agency, and was fortunate enough to attend several conferences, and became clear after a couple of conferences hearing people from New York talk about some of the issues that came up around the Chinatown area and people not having having lost their sponsors and that kind of thing, that how easily that could happen here in Hawaii. And so as part of my role, I came back, and thank goodness for relationships, and our relationship is one that is very favorable with our state civil defense agency, and really started talking about how we can better engage the LEP population in our efforts and really try to avoid and get like ahead of the game. So they talked about a language card. And, you know, traditionally the health department has been one to look at, okay, we'll have a card, as Gerald says, and says what language you speak and may give you a little bit of health information. But what we were thinking about was something well beyond that, was something about how, something that added a little more information, that provided us ways to anticipate resources, to look at how that whole response process, and how if people came into a shelter, for example, how we can identify who their significant others are, how we can contact families, how we can get them in and out of the shelter, and find their families. And for any of you who have visited Hawaii, you may know and be familiar with many of our schools, for example, have Hawaiian names. Many of our businesses, our streets all have Hawaiian names. And for limited English speaking, it's very difficult. You know, they may say, oh, my child goes to Queen, I can't remember which Queen school. So it's very it becomes very important for us to help to be able to identify that kind of detail, particularly in times of stress, and for emergency responders to be able to help limited English individuals through that process. So the other thing we realized is we needed a mechanism that would help help us engage those agencies that work with this population, because both civil defense, the health department could not possibly do this alone. So we wanted to make sure that we had a process that would engage those who are already have the expertise in working with these populations to really see how important preparedness is, and to start incorporating in preparedness messages and the importance of being prepared and our emergency response system as part of the kind of work they do. It's just incorporated in what they do. It helps newly arrived individuals, for example, know and understand our system. So the project got started. It has almost no budget. In fact, it had no budget. We really, when we had to use interpreters, we had to scrounge for other funds and of some available funds, and Marcia will go through some of the detail. We frankly thought it would be maybe 6-7 languages. We just start there, and Marcia will also share with you that it grew way beyond, and we thought it may be a few months, and it went well over just a little over a year. So, and we're still in process. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Marcia.
Okay. The card, as you can see, is the size of a business card with 5 folded panels imprinted on both sides. One of the things about the project was I found the project partnership and a working group necessary to bounce ideas and reviews off of. Our project had both of these, and so which was very good. So today, our presentation is actually missing my Department of Health partner, Lisa Nakao. Without Lisa, I don't think this project would have been completed. This was Lisa and my first translation project, and so having someone to collaborate with allowed us to share the workload, increase the resources, and provided a shared memory, which reduced the number of things that fell through the cracks. And having someone believe with you that the project must be done was critical to completing this project. These are the languages that we used, and our working group collaborated on this, as Barbara said, and 20 translations were actually done, 16 were printed, and 2 are being field tested. The card empowers the LEP population to identify their language of preference and to those who don't speak their language so they can have access to services and resources. It provides them with the same disaster preparedness messages used with the English-speaking population. So now, once you have your partner and working group, what you want to do is you want to keep your English simplified and, for example, use the word fix instead of repair, clarify the text. Some English words are all-encompassing, where the translation may need to be specific. For example, in the law section of our card, we had the word you. We clarified the word you by incorporating your agency so that translators didn't have to guess who you was. Some translators did not know that individuals didn't receive federal and state funding. So field test your English text with both experts and non-experts. Be clear about who your target audience is. What's the level of education, age, gender? They influence how the translation is worded because some languages are more gender-oriented than English or have a formality hierarchy based on the age of the audience. Some LEP groups' migration occurred over decades. And so those who have been here a long time and have been some acculturation may have some understanding of English terms, whereas recent arrivals will not. Their primary language also has evolved in the former country in comparison to the use of their language in our country. So recent arrivals may not use the same words as older migrants. Regional differences may also be a factor. In Micronesia, there are four major languages that differ from island to island. Get buy-in from everybody. We found a number of state and nonprofit agencies with multilingual individuals who volunteered to translate and field test for us. In one case, we made our mission so compelling to a language professor who used the card translation as a class project. It was important for us to obtain buy-in from organizations that work with LEP groups. These would be the agencies with interpreters as well as others that don't have them. Examples of agencies with interpreters are nonprofits or government agencies that serve LEP groups, but may not have had prioritizing emergency preparedness for their clients or agencies. Organizations that serve the LEP but don't have interpreters are often first responders, emergency managers, and shelter agencies who may be presented with the card. By taking the cards to these agencies, we not only informed them about the card, but got support for its use. Not being fluent in all the languages, we could not evaluate the translations until they were field tested. Assessments were based on the evaluation of others. Assuming any native speakers able to do the job is false. Some cards had two or three translators. Some languages are used in multiple countries, which could affect the translation. Gender, age, the region the translator comes from, and how long the translator has lived outside of their country may influence the translation. Negotiations with paid translators included post-field test changes in the price and that payment would be made after completion of the field test changes. Translations were done in MS Word for email purposes. This helped track edited versions, but some field testers didn't have computers, so changes were handwritten. When field tests were done with both translations, the handwritten version was preferred, but required going back to the original translator to make the change. This type of change may have additional charges. Some cultures are also not as time sensitive, so translations and field testing may take longer. And this can occur even with paid translators. Translations are dependent on the translator's understanding of the English version and its context. Prepping the translators reduces questions and mistakes. For example, we chose to use the words advisories, watches, and warnings because these are the terms used by National Weather Service. Concern about literacy level of the target audience made translators want to simplify the terms. We also added know how to call your family to the National Ready campaign message because LEP groups often have less resources and may rely on family or key support people more. Some words imply or conjure up a less positive image. Ask translators to identify these. Example, Citizen Corps. The word corps in some languages evokes a militaristic image instead of an esprit de corps. It's important to know if a language culture does not have positive images of the words used in translation or the subjects are culturally sensitive as it may affect use. Apologize if necessary. some words may not translate in some languages, so they may use anglicized versions or of the English. Consistency with radio or TV broadcast programs is also important. Our Japanese translator did not reside in Hawaii and used the anglicized name for civil defense. The radio station here uses the Japanese term for civil defense. Ultimately, we used both names. Review.
We have 2 more minutes left.
Even though you don't understand, to look for consistency. Translators are not always consistent about punctuation. As you can see, both translations here have punctuation marks, but they're different, and both fonts, the simplified and the traditional fonts, can be used for Mandarin and Cantonese. Some languages have changed how they spell their name. Some languages require special fonts for translation and printing. Some languages have changed how they spell their names. And some translators add their own text. Radio and TV were not in the English text, but were added in this translation. We use the same methods for evaluating translators and field testers. The best way to field test is to ask field testers to explain or back translate. We maintained a policy of not telling who did the translation, so people were not influenced in their evaluation of the translation. Field test the translations with native speakers more than once. We put our information on spreadsheets to keep track of them and renamed our files. The translations are not the end of it. Our translations were converted from one software to another, and then we found that punctuation marks were dropped. In our case, the conversions were from MS Word to InDesign. Again, field test the conversions with translators or field testers. We initially believed that the card's use would be apparent. At a language fair, we found people picked up the cards but needed to be directed to complete the card and place it in their wallets by an interpreter. Those not directed to do so put the cards in a bag, and we had no idea whether or not they were read or not. Outreach to organizations with interpreters who work with LEP groups embed the messages of preparedness while explaining the card's use. Concepts are not easily understood can be explained, such as disaster plan and disaster kit. People would say they don't plan for disasters. Use trusted community resources to identify which concepts are not easily understood. By working with agencies, we get our preparedness messages embedded in their organization's consciousness also, so they are prepared to assist the LEP in preparedness and recovery. We ask interpreters to ask LEP groups to volunteer to assist others less fluent in English to be better prepared, to interpret in shelters, and to help throughout the disaster phases. We prepared for input once the cards were printed. We called this version 1 and plan to take names and numbers of those with suggestions so they can become part of our next working group. We are in the process of putting the cards in PDF formats that can be completed on the web and printed by individuals to reduce printing costs. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gerald, Marcia, and Barbara. We will next have our next speaker, Herman Schaffer. But before we have him begin, I understand some people might be experiencing some technical difficulties. If you have any technical difficulties, please email khayden, K-H-A-Y-D-E-N, at migrationpolicyoneword.org. And the reason why we ask you to email instead of put the question in the chat box is we don't know your email from the chat box. So if you do ask a question through the chat box, just leave your email. So onward to you, Herman. Thank you.
Am I off mute? All right, great. My name is Herman Schaffer. I'm the Director of Community Outreach for the New York City Office of Emergency Management. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit broadly about our language access projects, a little bit about New York City specifically, and why language access and working with limited English proficient communities and immigrant communities is so important to us. But before I went into that, I wanted to spend a few minutes going over sort of who I work for and what programs we work with. The New York City Office of Emergency Management was established in 1996. We work on the city, state, and federal levels. We also work with nonprofit, private companies, and faith-based institutions. And more specifically, we do that through our external affairs division, of which I am a director in. OEM has several different missions. We work to coordinate emergency response throughout the entire city, the five boroughs. Through our operations center, we also do field responses. And in relation to this, we do a lot of our work is planning, and we plan to figure out how best to manage emergencies and do interagency coordination. Another one of our larger and more applicable to this conversation is our community outreach and education programs. And that's done through the External Affairs Division. And I currently oversee the Citizen Corps Council program, which I'll talk a little about in a second, as well as the CERT, which is a Community Emergency Response Team program. And we work very closely with our Ready New York programs, communications, which does our websites and other sort of communication tools, and our public-private. So we're all connected together and working together with the same goal of making sure that we're getting our preparedness message and out into as wide a community as possible. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Citizen Corps Council because it's a program that I'm the chairperson for here for New York City. We currently, the Citizen Corps Council has about 40 different agencies that are actually actively involved with it, and we have four different task forces. They all focus on what we call vulnerable populations or groups that would be more vulnerable to the effects of an emergency. And we talk, when we say that, we talk about youth, people with special needs, and that could be mobility, that can be cognitive. And then we also talk about immigrant and limited English proficient. We have a task force specifically to address how we work within that community. And I wanted to take a moment to note who the major players on that task force are. We have American Red Cross in Greater New York. We have a group that's called the Consortium for Haitian Empowerment that works specifically with the Haitian community. We have the Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs, Catholic Charities, both Archdiocese and Catholic Charities of Brooklyn, Queens, World Care Center, Borough President's Office, Jewish Community Relations Council, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and then we can draw from the rest of the broader part of the council. And I did want to take a second to highlight how important it is. And really, one of the questions I was asked when I was trying to prepare this presentation was, well, how do you make this sustainable? How do you make this something that other communities can do as well? And that's all dependent really on your partnerships and your ability to build and sustain these partnerships within your community. Without those partnerships, you may have a great product, but you're not going to be able to get buy-in, you're not going to be able to get their commitment, and you're not going to be able to get their advice on how to do it. So the Citizen Corps Council functions as a think tank, a group of organizations that are focused on emergency preparedness. And each of these task forces focuses their the time they spend on the Citizen Corps Council, because it's a voluntary effort, on how to addressing and how best to get our messages out and what sort of messages should we be promoting. Because we now know that a lot of our programs are very broad because they can address a whole community, somewhat similar to the Ready.gov campaign. But we also find that through anecdotal but also through our research is that when people see a very broad campaign, they don't see that that really focuses on themselves. So what we're trying to do with the Citizen Corps Council here is being able to tailor that message to these specific groups in a way that will address them and that they will see that it addresses them and that, therefore, hopefully, they will follow the the guidance and the education that we're providing them. In a similar vein, the Ready New York campaign is our version of the Ready.gov. And the Ready.gov campaign, as we all know, is a general preparedness message for families. It's a personal preparedness message. The Ready New York is similar as well. And I'm going to give you a website. Our website is www.nyc.gov/OEM. And then you'll see a symbol that says Ready New York. And you can see that we have multiple different guides. We have one that's just a general preparedness guide specifically to the threats to New York City. We have one for Beat the Heat, two different guides for kids, different age groups, seniors and people with disabilities, hurricanes in New York City, Ready New York flooding, businesses, pets. We have a pocket guide that people can take with them. But we also have our newest guide, which is a pandemic flu guide, which is what the majority of my presentation is going to be on. So those guides are translated into a number of different languages. And when we were producing these guides, we were able to do a lot of thought into what languages we want to want these to be translated into. As many of you know, New York City is a very densely populated city with a very diverse population, and therefore the impact of a disaster would be greatly amplified by having so many people concentrated in a small area, but also the cultural thought of how these would affect people and also the isolation that comes with some immigrant populations. So therefore we created what we called social vulnerability. And we developed a method using our GIS or geographic information system and census data to do a social vulnerability analysis in which we looked at age, ethnicity, income, and various different vulnerabilities, as we called them, that would make people more affected, more affected by or more vulnerable to the effects of a disaster. And so understanding the specific social vulnerabilities of our city was our first step in creating a more resilient community. The foreign-born population makes up 36% of the city's population. The five languages other than English spoken by more than 100,000 people in the city are Spanish, Chinese, Russian, Italian, and French. Of those who do not speak English, 51% are Spanish-speaking households, 13% Chinese, 8% Russian, 4% French, including Haitian Creole, 3% Korean, 2% Polish, and 16% count for other languages. About 15% of our households throughout the city, there is no one above the age of 13 that speaks English well. And so this really highlighted a very, very important need of ours to be able to address these populations, but also do it effectively. And so we do that partially through our partnerships with multiple different agencies, nonprofits, faith-based groups, but we also wanted to do a lot more with our education and through our Ready New York program. And we had a great opportunity, thanks to our partners at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, our local health department, to do this when we were developing our Ready New York for Pandemic Flu Guide. This guide was funded through the CDC, by the CDC, by a subgrant through our local health department, the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And we partnered with Department of Health on this, but also our Medical Reserve Corps volunteers to sort of help us develop and deliver this message. We were also very lucky that through this grant, we were able to hire several vendors, including GlobalWorks, which is a translation company who also does focus groups, Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, and Maimonides Hospital here in New York City. And I just wanted to touch on a few key points about our project with this. This was started in August of 2008, so prior to the whole H1N1 scare. So we were very lucky in being proactive around this guide and around our messaging. And we were also, given that it wasn't necessarily an emergency that was happening at that moment, we were very lucky to have the time to be able to put into, as Hawaii said, pretest, and making sure that you're getting the right message out there. We all know that pandemic flu 1918, and it's on people's minds now with H1N1, is a very difficult and very specific message that you need to be giving out. If you give the wrong message, you have serious ramifications as to the effect it would have on that public that you had just given that message to. And so we were able to do a lot of focus groups with non-English speakers to make sure that the language in the guide, once it was translated, was culturally relevant and something that would convey the message that we were trying to do. So we started with several focus groups that focused on Spanish, Russian, and Chinese speakers who were immigrants to New York City. And these were done in language. And based on these focus groups, we were able to better understand what language would work within these communities. And after these focus groups were done, OEM and DOHMH, Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, developed outreach and marketing plans and a presentation that would correspond with this, which we then trained our Medical Reserve Corps volunteers as medical professionals to be able to go out and do these presentations. And this was August 2008 to April 2009. So we did have a lot of time to be able to put into the development of this guide and the language, and very, very specific language that would be okay with both OEM and DOHMH, but also would work with the various different populations that we have here in New York City. And April 2009, as we all know, H1N1 flu emerged in New York City. And from April to June, we were able to translate our guide into 23 languages and also an audio tape. And based on the study that we did with our Language Access Project, we were able to determine the top 23 languages that are common in New York City. And these were translated and then reviewed to make sure that the translation was correct using the language that we had developed earlier with the focus groups. And we're able to put these out on our web within the first week after the H1N1 discussion started and what we saw happening here in New York City.
Two more minutes left.
Okay, thank you so much. During the initial mailing, we were able to send out 35,700 of these guides to hospitals, health clinics, elected official community boards, senior centers to be able to get a wide swath of the community, and most of these groups serve LEP and immigrant communities. But this is where people would be going if they were worried, they're worried well or anything like that, to be able to get information that was culturally competent and culturally relevant. Due to the high demand, we had to print another 100,000 from the 200,000 that we actually had printed with the CDC grant. So we had at this time 300,000 total that were printed. And also in June, which actually corresponded very nicely, we conducted an annual preparedness poll, and we were able to include questions about the pandemic, and more importantly, questions about our messaging. So we were able to get immediate feedback as to how good our message was. Starting in June through September currently in 2009, we were able to do follow-up and then do evaluation of what we were able to do with this project. And we did that with Columbia University Mailman Public Health School of Public Health and Maimonides High Hospital. in Brooklyn. And we were able to do it with ethnic communities, including African-American, Jamaican, Chinese, Dominican, Greek, and Indian, Bengali, as well as Pakistani, Russian, and Orthodox Jewish. And what we were able to do is get recommendations from this. And I think these are some things that, you know, hopefully the group will be able to take back. And some of what we already knew is the importance of developing community partners. The message is once it comes through someone they trust as a community member and also a community leader, it becomes a much stronger message. Religious leaders and institutions were in the same category as that, but they pulled them out because it highlighted how important that was. It also highlighted the difficulty with the cultural interpretation of isolation and quarantine. I think this is something that we saw early on and we tried to address in our initial guide, but isolation, quarantine, maybe something that we're used to hearing, but in a different language, in a different culture, it means something completely different. Using telephone and internet resources for non-English speaking communities is really important, and we have a 311 that has a simultaneous translation service built into it, which is fantastic. And then also the word of mouth. The average person who saw a presentation spoke to an average of 9.5 people about that. So the way of spreading it through communities by being able to do it in a way that's culturally competent but also in language for them is incredibly important with our outreach. So this just is a great project for us because we were able to do a lot of pre-testing, do the project, take surveys, and then follow up with evaluation phase that was done by a reputable school. It highlighted a lot of really great things in New York City, and it was just a great project to be able to work on.
Thank you so much, Herman.
No problem.
And so for our next speaker, we have Uma Aluwalia as well as Betty Lamb from the Montgomery County Department of Health and Human Services. We are already receiving questions through the chat box, and just to let you know, we will take all the questions during the question and answer period at the end of the Montgomery County presentation. So we are in the process of unmuting your line, and are we unmuted? Yeah. And we're ready to go with your presentation, Montgomery County.
Great. Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning to Hawaii. Montgomery County, Maryland is a suburb of Washington, D.C., and what we thought we would do is give a little bit of the context of the county. There are two of us here, Betty Lamb, who is the manager of our community outreach for the department, and myself, Uma Aluwalia, who's the director of the department. We're a fully integrated health and human services department, so we serve our customers from birth to death with all manner of services related to public health, behavioral health, income supports and child welfare, juvenile justice, diversion, early learning, child care, homeless services, and aging and disability services. So that gives you a sense of, from a standpoint of emergency preparedness and public health response that and sheltering, we actually have ESF 6 and ESF 8 in the department, for those of you who know that language. So Montgomery County is the most populous county in the state of Maryland, and we have a population close to a million, about 986,000. We're pretty sure that we will inch over a million within the next couple of years. According to the American Community Survey of 2006, we had a foreign-born population of 29.3%, and the total minority population in our county grew from about 27% in 1990 to about 41.8% in the year 2006. So that gives you a sense of how many people there are here. The LEP population in the county has doubled to about 135,000. The language diversity, as you can see there, we've captured in the slide some of the languages that are spoken in the county, but the three, the vastly majority spoken languages besides English are Spanish, Chinese, French, Korean, some of the African languages, and then there are Asian languages like Hindi and Bengali, that are pretty prevalent here as well. In one zip code in our county, in the 2000 census, there were 135 languages spoken in this one particular zip code. The English-speaking ability of a foreign-born population varies, and you can see from that slide that there are varying levels, and we experience that in terms of how to communicate our messages. This ends up being a pretty significant factor in our thinking. So here are the top languages, 12 languages in the county that we have outlined: English, Spanish, Chinese, Hindi, Korean, French, Vietnamese, Amharic, Farsi, Russian, Tagalog, and Portuguese. Our Department of Health and Human Services, because we're serving a very diverse semi-suburban population adjacent to the nation's capital, as somebody was saying yesterday, we're literally on the red line for the federal government. So in terms of easy access, we're very, very easily accessible on the metro line. And because of our close proximity to NIH and other national health resources, there's a lot of the folks who work at NIH, who work in the federal government, live in this county, and so there tends to be a greater awareness among our residents on any public health issue, and there is an immediate expectation that the county, the department, is going to be responsive. And our focus includes public health emergency awareness, education, and systems to dispense medication supplies, vulnerable populations such as young children and seniors. And about three years or so ago, we received the CDC Advanced Practice Center grant award. And since then, since 2004 actually, so it's been 5 years, and this center is housed in our public health emergency preparedness office. And later on, there is a slide in which there is a web address for the Advanced Practice Center, which has a lot of toolkits for preparedness, kind of like what New York said, you know, pandemic flu preparedness and stay at home, what's needed for families to stay at home. And it's available in a couple of different languages as well. And it's been critical that an integrated component of our preparedness has been to test and design our APC tools. So as we develop them and design them, we apply them in county government and test them in a live laboratory. So the philosophy behind the Advanced Practice Center's preparedness planning is around the direct interpersonal going to the next tier, which is with primary groups, family, community, going to the institutional, going even further out to not just the neighborhood, but to the larger community, and then widening out to the public policy level and an ecological behavioral health model. So then in terms of identifying our gatekeepers, you can see we have many touch points in the community, community health nurses, home health aides. We have outreach workers for different communities who are from those communities and have a certain competence, and then our public and private agencies. Within county government, the emergency preparedness and response for vulnerable populations, there's a committee, and that committee comprises of public health emergency preparedness, homeland security, community affairs, senior health promotion, staff, aging and disabilities, police, volunteer center, health promoter programs and community groups, advocacy groups, hospitals, and that whole cluster of residential and faith-based providers who join forces with us. And within that, there is actually a group that focuses on emergency preparedness for vulnerable populations. So who are our community partners as we think about doing this work? Faith communities, businesses, home care agencies, pharmacists, child care providers. We have universities who are partners with us. We're pretty university rich over here, so we tend to get a lot of academic institution interest, outreach workers, community advocates, school systems, physicians, nurses, schools of public health, hospitals, ethnically based community nonprofits, and volunteers, to name a few. This is the stay-at-home toolkit that was actually prepared by the Advanced Practice Center, and there's a website here where there are many, many tools that are available for other jurisdictions. We want you to take them. There are, on average, at this website, there tend to be about 40,000 hits. As you know, depending on the interest, heightening of interest or waning of interest, this varies. But right now, with the particular interest in H1N1 and influenza-like illnesses, we are seeing a lot of hits at this website. And we encourage everybody on the call, if you're interested, this is free. It's paid for by the feds, and all the work has been done to use them. We did prepare curriculum for our outreach workers and promoters with emergency preparedness training and what's included, and plan to be safe tools. This information, too, is available, and we're happy to share it with folks. This was actually developed based on group studies to educate our gatekeepers on day-to-day work within the Latino community. So it's another resource that's available. Now, coming more immediately to H1N1, which is where we wanted to put a little bit of our focus, given that we have a population of 1 million, we've estimated, based on complex algorithms that only public health planning folks know, about 600,000 of these folks will be eligible for different vaccinations. And as all of you know, we have to very close to each other, run the seasonal flu immunization and the H1N1 immunizations. And so this September, in another week, we've been planning intensely with our public school system to begin vaccinations of students, seasonal flu vaccinations, and seasonal flu vaccinations for the population at large, because there's no shortage of the seasonal flu vaccine. And then in October, when the H1N1 vaccine comes, there will be an overlap for priority populations and for the immunizations to be given in the school. So as you can imagine, there's a fair amount of coordination going on. And so we've begun. We've done some website notification. We've actually sent parent letters and informed consent forms for the seasonal flu vaccine. They went out September 1 to all of the parents in English and 6 other languages. We sent them home with the students. We've done websites. We've reached out to the PTAs. The superintendent has gone on community cable. Our health officer has gone on county cable, school system cable, county cable. The county website has information. I think I've lost some percentage of my staff in public health to just H1N1 planning. Each school has notified parents of vaccination dates in their specific schools, and there's a very complex schedule where we've actually factored in how many minutes it would take for a student to enter, be vaccinated, and exit. And based on that, they've determined how many students can be vaccinated daily, and those projections have been used to determine staffing. So the seasonal flu vaccination dose 1 begins September 23rd, and then the second dose will be administered around October 24th for those who've never had a flu vaccine before. And then the H1N1 vaccination schedule is yet to be determined. There is some uncertainty as to when in October that is going to be available. The goals for the school-based vaccination program, on average, we have about 140,000 students enrolled in the public school system. Of that, we're focusing particularly on elementary school students and pre-K and Head Start, and that we want to vaccinate about 32,000 students at the school sites. Now, we've also notified private schools of availability of vaccines, but we're also encouraging them to go to their own pediatricians, but are made aware of the schedule. Then the primary flu vaccine, we're going to provide the flu mist, and then the second dose is only for 10 to 30% of the students, and then there will be 10% of the students who cannot tolerate the mist and will have to be given the IM vaccine. We intend to complete both the doses somewhere by November and the H1N1 will begin to overlap in October. So this is really taxing our public health, school health resources. We've also produced in many languages and sent flyers and posters and hit the airways, radio, TV, sort of the tiered response that CDC has now provided guidance on as to when students must stay home and when they can come to work or come back to school, when employees can stay home and when they can come back to school, and the availability of personal protective equipment for school nurses, and the availability of prophylaxis. So all of this information has sort of begun to seep the airways, and we're also, the states put up a call line, and we're in the process of figuring out when our call line goes up. So to summarize, parent letters and informed consent forms have been developed in English and six other languages regarding both the seasonal flu and H1N1. Those forms can be printed off of the website, both the county government and the public school website. We've developed a vaccine dispensing card to keep track of the vaccines. All of our 131 elementary schools are prepared and ready to run the vaccine clinics. All of our, for additional, we've recruited physicians, and we've recruited the one-minute clinics have signed up, you know, the grocery stores at the local pharmacies, and a lot of the culturally language competent physicians through the Board of Physicians and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Our State Department's been reaching out to them to not only convey certain select messages to the public and to their patients, but also they have signed up then to become community dispensing sites. And today, in fact, in a high-level department director meeting, the decision was to also look at parks and recreation facilities, libraries, and fire stations as possible sites for dispensing vaccines to make sure that we're able to reach as much of the public as we can. Now, there are the harder messages, the priority populations that we need to think about as in the initial availability of the H1N1 vaccine, because by December we anticipate that everybody can be immunized, but not in the first round. And as you can imagine, the non-EMS police and fire and rescue staff are pretty anxious, and our unions are asking when we're going to make, you know, the vaccine available. In addition, there are lots of questions, and our personnel department's actually issuing guidance on how employers can send their employees home on sick leave and to make advanced sick leave available if somebody doesn't have sick leave, how to manage all of that so that it is not an administrative leave situation if, in fact, an employee is sick with a flu-like symptom. And since there is going to be no testing for H1N1, unless there's a hospital environment for either H1N1, or for the seasonal flu, it's going to be hard to distinguish which is which. We're also telling people, even if they get the flu-like symptoms, they should still take the vaccine because we wouldn't know which flu they might have caught. So those are all some of the activities we're engaged in. We will continue to completely immerse the airways and the radio and television with public interest messages and using county cable very strategically. The state and county have set up an information line. We're in the process of determining, you know, we can ramp up very quickly. We've done it for past emergencies. The question is, how much, you know, it's all the algorithm of determining how much resource do you apply now before the epidemic actually hits, even though the illness is all over and prevalent in the community, and how much, you know, how quickly do we ramp up to what level when. So we have not yet activated our call line, but we'll likely do so within the week. By the time the immunizations begin, we'll have the call line up. And in addition, you know, we do daily tracking at the school system of the absences and how many of those absences are related to flu-like symptoms. So those are some of the activities that we've been engaged in, like everybody else around the country. We spend hours and hours on conference calls listening to the feds and listening to our state and then planning locally. And we're ready to do the partial activation of our emergency response center as soon as there is, a ramping up of the illness. And so we're getting ready is the best way I can describe it.
Thank you so much, Uma. Very interesting presentation. So I'm going to open it up for questions. And just to let you know, there are two ways that you can ask a question. One is to enter a question in the chat box, and the other is to press star one for the question queue. If you're having trouble accessing the site, you can also email Kristen Hayden at khayden@migrationpolicy.org. So we have a variety of questions, and I'm going to actually take our first voice question from Rita Woodfin, and we are just about to unmute your line right now, Rita. Rita?
Good afternoon. This is Rita from Los Angeles Superior Court. I actually was trying to break in earlier. I barely was able to hear much of Herman's presentation because the vocal part was just too low. So that was the nature of my punch in the star one. But that's done now.
Oh, okay. All right. Great. So our first question is from Mr. or Mrs. Furno. I can't tell. What do you do for families that do not read in any language? What plans do you have for those that speak a language other than one of the majority languages in the region? And I'm going to open up this question to Hawaii, Montgomery County, or New York City. And right now, we are in the process of unmuting all of your lines.
Thank you, Clinton. Thank you.
This is Herman. I'm sorry, my presentation actually. I hope not everyone had that same problem, and people can hear me now. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about what our plans were. Specifically to the Write New York program, we do have them on audio tape in several different languages as well. But a lot of what our outreach strategy is.
Not literate in any language.
Sorry, Hawaii, you're just. We can hear what you're saying, so just be quiet while we're having Herman answer.
So that's one option is to be able to put it on audio tape so people can hear it. We also are exploring, and I think we've got one of our guides up on the website in the same way that you can stream audio. But also, we found that sometimes just the brochures themselves, even for people who aren't LEP or have who speak another language, are difficult because of comprehension and things. So presentations are the best, and we actually use a lot of our volunteers in their own communities, CERT volunteers, Medical Reserve Corps volunteers, to help multiply our ability to get out into community and actually just answer people's questions and address their concerns.
This is Betty Lamb with Montgomery County. If you notice that in our slides, for example, the Plan 9 products that were produced from our Advanced Practice Center, a lot of it is based on pictures and photographs. So that's what we are testing right now to see if the pictures and the photographs that were used can be a simpler way of communicating the information rather than too much of a narrative description of what needs to be done in terms of preparation for emergency preparedness. So that's one way we are trying to address the literacy issue.
Hello, this is Barbara from Hawaii. I'm really grateful for this conversation because I know for us the H1N1 documents and materials that are coming from CDC, and in fact I've asked this question, are so high literacy, and it's been very difficult for us because we really are very much wanting more pictures, fewer words, to convey the message because of our diverse population. So I'm very grateful for this conversation because it's very helpful. And I don't know how to influence, and I wonder if this is something collectively or MPI, those, you know, because it saves us all if we could get some national materials that are already designed that way instead of trying to, you know, take these high literacy materials that are produced nationally and have to bring it down to lower levels. So I don't know how we can advocate collectively, but it would be nice if there's a way that we could do that.
Great. And so I actually have a question specifically for Herman. How has the OEM overcome the cultural barriers from people, from LEP people towards the concept of emergency preparedness? What are the RQ levels by different population groups? Are they different? Have you followed up? Why?
And that actually is a fantastic question. We don't actually the short answer, I guess, is that we don't really have quite enough data per group to be able to answer that completely. What we do is we have a lot of anecdotal and sort of us going out in the community and talking to people. What we do find is that there are certain groups that are much more interested in emergency preparedness, and I'm not sure exactly why that is, but what we found is that the Chinese groups in New York City are much more open to the message about emergency preparedness, and we also found that Russian groups out in Brighton Beach are not so open to the idea of emergency preparedness. So it really does go from group to group. And so what we're trying to do is trying very actively to develop relationships with those different ethnic groups and actually just go out there and talk to them specifically about this. And sometimes that means organizing a specific conference in that area and inviting various different leaders. But it's a difficult question to answer because each group seems to take a different viewpoint on it. And also the other problem that we're facing is that if the message seems to be coming too much from government only, that also turns some immigrant or LEP groups off. Specifically because they don't either trust that message. And that's something we're trying to tackle more specifically with H1N1 is the messaging coming from their own community versus exclusively from the government.
Okay, and we have another voice question from Arthur Upham. So we just unmuted you, Arthur, and you can go ahead and ask your question.
I'm connected with the Association of State Refugee Health Coordinators. They just had a teleconference which included CDC, and the name of a contact person at CDC preparing material to put on their website about the H1N1 is Erica Willacy, and I think she'd be glad to hear from people so that CDC puts up information that is health literate as well, I mean, for people with low health literacy as well.
And so, Arthur, do you know if they have not just low literacy but multilingual? Is she the right contact for multilingual research as well?
I believe they're also working on that.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that suggestion. And so I actually have a question for Montgomery County. I noticed that one of the solutions and one of the things that you're preparing for is for children to just stay home when they are sick. And for many low-income immigrant parents, they might not be able to take the time off of work to stay home with their child when he or she is sick. Have there been preparations made for kids who come to school while sick because there is no one to take care of them at home?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. We have talked about sick child care centers, but we haven't actually been able to move in them. The economic environment has been so tough. When children do come to school, there are isolation protocols that school health nurses will initiate, and if parents are able to come and pick up the children, then we go ahead and do that. Now, CDC has, in fact, relaxed the rules that the child doesn't have, you know, in the spring, the guidance that came out was that they had to stay home for 7 days. Now they've relaxed it considerably, and it's only until the child has no fever for 24 hours without any fever-suppressing medication. So we have been tracking at the school system when children are sick, and it has I'm sure parents are having a difficult time, but we have not had parents, you know, bring sick children to school. In general, the nurses are reporting that parents are complying. There's whatever child care arrangements they're making, and we have not, I mean, we're generally seeing an increase in parents coming to us for assistance on many economic levels just because of the economic situation right now. We can't attribute that specifically to H1N1. Since the school opened 2 weeks ago, we've had about 49 children out with flu-like symptoms. And so we're continuing to track it by school, but we don't have any county-driven program for sick child care if parents have to go to work.
Great, thank you. And for Hawaii, a question about the language identification and emergency card. Do you have statistics on usage, and do you know if our emergency responders trained to look for these cards?
I don't have any statistics right now, but what we have done is we've engaged with the different police and fire, some of the police and fire departments. And we've also engaged with the emergency management personnel so that, you know, we are trying to get everybody to recognize what the cards look like, what information is on there. And for police departments now, their concern is what kinds of medications people are on when they are apprehended. So the card would be very helpful, and so we're in the process of continuing engagement right now and educating.
Great, and we have another voice question coming online from Lillian McDonald. You are on mute now, so please feel free to ask your question. Hello, Lillian.
Hi.
Hi, do you have a question?
Are you asking for Lillian from Echo?
Hi.
Wonderful. I just wanted to make note that I'm enjoying the presentation, and I'd like to support the presenter's point about multimedia formats and the importance of face-to-face as well, more so than print, in particular because of translation inconsistencies, literacy challenges, and more. Echo Minnesota has put together materials likewise for phone, for web, for phone, and for TV with bilingual spokespersons, because we also find that embracing LEP or bilingual or ESL, whichever phrase you want to call it, spokespersons, is much more valuable for members of the community. It becomes more believable, more credible, and more understandable. So we're hoping to be posting these materials for shareware. And I just wanted to plug it and support the speakers on the webinar today. It'll be posted at echominnesota, all spelled out, .org, our website, echominnesota.org.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And so I have another question for New York City. You mentioned that there was a preparedness poll conducted in June. And the other thing I wanted to mention while I'm asking a question of New York City, you guys were very lucky in the sense that you were in the process of already developing a pandemic flu guide and then in the process of translating it when H1N1 hit. So you are in an exceptionally unique situation. So I just wanted to acknowledge that. But the other question is, was the preparedness poll conducted in languages other than English?
Actually, I don't believe so, which I think is something that is is of concern or something that we should might want to think about doing later. It's conducted by the Marispol. So we actually contract out to be able to do that. And also, so I don't think it was, if that answers the question, but I think that's something that we have definitely thought about and trying to figure out whether or not we have the resources to be able to do.
Great, thank you. And then for Montgomery County, I noticed that you had the guide, which we actually sent out to our participants ahead of time in an email on working with the Latino community and health promoters. Do you have similar guides for other immigrant communities?
The first one that was developed was with the Latino community only because the LEP population is so much bigger with the Spanish-speaking community. I don't want to say that it is something that they are looking at developing another set of curriculum with the other health promoters, but I would imagine that that would be the route that they would take. We do have a very robust health promoter model that we are using with a lot of our education and outreach, so it is not something that is too difficult to move toward in the near future.
Yeah, and the other thing, just gone to the prior question, Lorraine, I wanted to say the county every 2 years has been doing a livability survey. And this year, for the first time, they've actually, we pay a pay differential to our second language speakers who are tested for proficiency. We're actually translating the survey, and there are some emergency preparedness questions on that survey. And we're translating that into as many languages as we have the workforce trained and getting the differential and identifying them to help translate the survey so we can send it out and make sure that it hits as many of our residents as we can, particularly given that the census is coming. There is a significant urgency on our part to make sure that every person living in the county is counted because it translates to real money. So it's a very, very strong motivator to translate as many different languages as we can and access a lot of the community. So,
great. Thank you. And so we actually have they're very similar, the questions, so I'm going to group them together. Is there a national clearinghouse where all these materials can be placed and made available for all? Which website will offer information in diverse languages as to why to get the flu shot and also the H1N1 shot and how to take care of a child or adult when they are sick? I know this is very broad, so perhaps perhaps we can start with New York.
I was having a hard time listening to your question.
Is there a national clearinghouse where all the materials can be placed and made available for all? And which website will offer information in diverse languages as to why to get the flu shot and also the H1N1 shot and how to take care of a child or adult when they are sick?
Okay. Actually, what we are working on right now is that the nyc.gov/OEM site this month will go live as a Spanish site as well. Which is a big deal for us. It doesn't meet all the needs of the entire community, but that is something that we're very happy to be able to be doing. What we found the most productive way is that we have been building and maintaining really close connections with ethnic media. And we find that they're very helpful in making sure that the message goes out in language and in a source that people listen to. We don't find that people who don't really know about government or OEM or Department of Health don't go on our websites as much as people who are English speaking who expect to find those resources there. So we're trying to use our ethnic media partners as much as possible to be able to convey messaging, specifically emergency messaging, because the translation time for emergency messaging, by the time we get it back to us and make sure that is the correct message, would be prohibitive to being able to post it anywhere and make it useful. So we found that using our ethnic media partners to make sure a message goes out in an appropriate time is something that has been very effective for us.
In Montgomery County, is there one source that you go to for these resources? I know that you have your own site, which I'm really glad that you shared with our audience, but is there a site that you typically go to?
We rely a lot on the CDC website, and we've then translated a lot of the materials and done the work locally. So I don't know of any website nationally that has all the languages and all of this information posted, but as much material as we have developed, we're happy to share with the participants, because we have actually taken the very tiered response that CDC has now laid out for taking care of sick, you know, when they can return to work, when to take care of, what are now the different ways in which the school system or a workplace can respond. And we're beginning to then translate those, make them into simple speak, translate them, and start distributing them pretty widely in the county.
I have to say that the last time round with H1N1 in the county, CDC was a very reliable site with the main languages such as Spanish and maybe a few other languages such as Chinese and Korean and Vietnamese. And then we supplemented with our own translation when we cannot find it in the federal website. It would be good if CDC can be the national repository of some sort of approved
standardized
translation of materials. Yeah,
that's a great idea, and I'm hoping someone from the CDC is on the call. If not, I will for sure forward a copy of this webinar to them. We have another voice question from Nancy Shweta Nicholson, and you are unmuted, Nancy, so please go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks so much for taking my question. I'm immensely enjoying this webinar. Again, my name is Nancy Shweta Nicholson, and I'm a professor of linguistics at the University of Delaware, and I study language planning. So my question is, and this is directed generally to our group of speakers, you've all spoken about the use of volunteer and paid translators and interpreters, as well as the importance of partnering with community groups and obtaining buy-in on their part. With an increase in LEP speakers in the U.S. and increasing immigrant communities, have you seen a corresponding increase in minority group members who are working, who are actually employed in the emergency management field?
Sure.
I'll start with that. The employees, I think that New York City OEM has a very diverse staff here that we are able actually to pull when we're doing multiple language presentations. I've been here for 4 years now, and I believe I've seen increase in the diversity of our workplace here. I've also seen a big increase in our ability to recruit new immigrants and multiple people who speak multiple languages in our volunteer groups as well. And part of it may be because we're doing more outreach to these groups now, but I think that that's something that's making me very happy, is to be able to see a better representation in the people who are our direct voices into the community. And before I turn over to other people, I wanted to I'm hoping that everyone has seen this website before, but if you don't, Drexel University School of Public Health Center for Health Equality has put out a very interesting website, www.diversitypreparedness.org. And I found that to be a very good repository of multilingual publications from multiple different sources, and it's a very good repository of really good information.
Great. Montgomery County and Hawaii?
This is Hawaii. We have a very diverse population here. Everyone is a every population group is a minority, and so our emergency management personnel reflect that. But as far as, you know, statistically, whether or not we don't have any statistics on or data on what populations are represented or the languages they speak. We do have, through our Office of Language Access, we have office language access officers in every state department, and some of them have asked for bilingual to identify bilingual staff. But again, I don't have the data on that.
For example, in my division, I have bilingual workers, but up until, you know, they weren't necessarily involved in anything related to preparedness. So through this project, well, a little before this project, we really started making the link with our emergency management partners, because it became clear that if they were doing radio presentations and other media kinds of presentations, they should be involved with the preparedness community. So we're getting there.
In Montgomery County, we have in the department about 400-plus employees who are what we call language proficiency certified, a second language proficiency certified. Not all of them work in emergency preparedness.
But I would say that the county, this executive in particular now, has had a very strong goal of recruiting minorities into all walks of public life, and our police department, our fire and rescue, and our public health service has been very, very actively recruiting minorities, and so we reach pretty deep into these communities trying to find candidates, and there are we have different levels of success. The police department, for example, has been very successful in hiring Latino candidates, less successful in hiring Asian candidates, and so they then have been targeted, sort of focusing more on trying to see what parts of their messages can be tailored in what way to appeal to certain communities that are less well represented. So I see that Betty's right, in our department, we very closely mirror the community that we serve, which is not true for all departments in county, but because there is this particular focus around recruiting, some of those departments that perform emergency management functions are now beginning to see a wider representation, and I think we're also feeling hopeful about the future in terms of how the workforce is going to be more able to outreach. We are, on the other hand, we're very, very successful in getting community volunteers and outreach workers. We pay a stipend often to get outreach workers who can reach into these minority communities, and we train them, and we have both advisory committees and health initiatives that we attach these outreach workers to and who penetrate fairly deep into the community with our messages.
Okay, and it is now 5 p.m. East Coast time, so I will officially end this call. I had a few requests for the web address. It is actually diversitypreparedness.org, D-I-V-E-R-S-I-T-Y, preparedness, one word, .org for the Drexel University site. We also have suggestions for www.flu.gov. It has apparently English, Spanish, Chinese, and Vietnamese translations. And we also have a recommendation of another site that warehouses information. Let me just quickly find it. It is www.R as in Robert, H as in Howard, I as in Impact, N as in Nancy.org, Refugee Health Information Network. And with that, I just wanted to say a big thank you to all of our speakers on this call today. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your extremely busy schedules, especially now at the beginning of the school year, to come speak with us about the H1N1 preparations, as well as Hawaii's language and emergency identification card. Thank you so much for making the time, and also thank you so much for your work. Thank you, and goodbye.
Bye.